Next case is 00-1406, 00-1730, Judith Hubin versus Donald Hubin. Mr. Doherty.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to acknowledge, sitting at council table with me today are my client, Don Hubin, and James Hanneman, counsel for several of the amici. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Thank you. Members of the court, this case concerns how child support should be determined in shared parenting cases in which each parent has been designated as a residential parent and legal custodian. As the court knows, in every child support case, a worksheet must be completed. The worksheet contains a formula that requires the court to consider certain variables. The formula allocates the cost of raising a child between the parents. The costs are allocated proportionately based on each parent's income. After all computations are completed on the worksheet, each parent's proportionate share is stated on line 24 of the worksheet. On line 24, each parent's proportionate share is referred to as the parent's actual annual obligation. One obligation is stated for the father, and one obligation is stated for the mother. Thus, we have two obligations stated on line 24. And this is where the problem arises. One fundamental question is presented in this case. In a shared parenting case in which each parent has been designated as a residential parent and legal custodian, may a court completely eliminate one parent's line 24 obligation without first complying with the deviation standards stated in the statute?
Why should we not leave this to the legislature? They clearly said in the co-parenting situation that you do set off when you have that. But they have not said it here, which, you know, we have often said from this bench and in our opinions, the legislature knows how to write. When they write in one statute, we want X, and they don't put it in Y, it sends a clear message of their intent. Why should we as a court do that, especially in light of our previous decision? Why should we not leave that to the legislature? Because that is really a social policy issue as to what parent pays what obligation. And why should we, this, you know, up here without the benefit of any input from any groups and any hearings and any legislation, make that policy decision?
Justice Lundberg-Stratton, I think that the policy decision has already been made by the legislature. The provision that you refer to regarding split custody situations only requires the court to do an interim offset regarding the preliminary obligations. In every single situation,
and they don't require any preliminary offset in this statute, do they?
I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you.
So therefore, I go back to my statement. If they wanted us to do it, they could have said it, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think they have, because if we look at the split custody worksheet at the end, it's exactly like the worksheet that we use for sole custody and shared parenting. In both of those worksheets, you get down to a certain point, and it says father's obligation, deviated if appropriate, mother's obligation, deviated if appropriate. And then the next line on both worksheet goes from two obligations to one. So I think the legislature has clearly said to us, in all types of child support cases, you determine papa's obligation, mama's obligation, but then it'd be silly to make one pay to the other and simultaneously have a second order. So each of the two worksheets goes from two obligations to one obligation at the end. I agree with you, the legislature has spoken. I think it's spoken and it said we should go from two to one in all child support cases, including shared parenting cases.
Hasn't this court also spoken, though, counsel, in the Polly case? Doesn't Polly resolve your issue?
Not at all, Your Honor. In the Polly case, what the court specifically said was when a father came before the court and argued that he wanted a time-based deviation, this court rejected that argument. This court said, no, we're not going to read anything into the statute that says one must count up hours. The issue presented in this case is very different.
I think the court said no automatic set-off, no right to automatic set-off.
Yes, Your Honor. It specifically said no right to an automatic set-off based on time computations. That was the issue raised in the Court of Appeals in Pauley. That was the way the decision was phrased by this court. Your Honor, the first sentence in the Pauley decision written by Justice Sweeney says the issue before this court is whether a parent paying child support under a shared parenting plan is entitled to an automatic credit for the time his children reside with him. And a careful reading of that decision shows that what this court was doing, as I understand it, was rejecting a time-based analysis. We're not arguing for a time-based analysis
here.
Wouldn't
the rationale from the opinion apply to this case? I mean, we didn't just say there's no deviation. There's a rationale for it. Isn't the rationale consistent? In this case, wouldn't it be consistent to apply it here?
Well, Chief Justice Moyer, I don't think it does. In the Pauley case, I don't think that this court reached the question of do we begin with the presumption that each parent should pay his or her line 24 obligation. That issue simply was not reached in Pauley. Instead, what the court did, it began with what it was given. In the Pauley case, the status of the case when it came to you was that the trial court had ignored one of the parents' obligations. They had recognized the other parent's obligation, and they said, okay, do we give a deviation regarding that remaining obligation? They never addressed the more preliminary question of was it appropriate to recognize both of those obligations. So I don't think Pauley addressed the critical first question in this case. Your Honor, the 10th...
They read it to include this type of situation.
Yes, Your Honor. The 10th District Court of Appeals did reason in that manner. However, as you know, Your Honor, this is a diversity case. This is a case where two other courts of appeals who looked at the issue in much greater depth said that the 10th District approach is incorrect. The 1st District and the 11th District have both said in a shared parenting case where both parents are designated as residential parent and legal custodian, you must recognize both parents' obligations. And after that starting point, after you recognize both parents' obligations, you can then move on to the next step, which is to determine if a deviation is appropriate regarding either obligation. So yeah, we lost in the 10th District. I guess if we would have been in the 1st District or the 11th, we would have won. But clearly we've got a split among the courts, and we need this court to help us clarify what the proper approach is. Your Honor, I think that the beginning of our analysis must be the language of the statute itself. And I think the statute is clear. What the statute says is that in every child support case, the court must initially presume that the proper amount of child support to be paid is the line 24 obligation. The child support statute specifically states that the amount of child support calculated through line 24, and I now quote, is rebuttably presumed to be the correct amount of child support due. Close quote. The statute then goes on and explains how that presumption should be applied. The statute says that a court shall order the amount computed through line 24 to be paid as child support unless a deviation is appropriate. It then goes on to say that a court shall not order any amount that differs from the line 24 amount unless a deviation is appropriate. Now, how does the legislature say that that presumption can be rebutted? Well, the legislature says that the presumption can be rebutted if the party seeking to rebut the presumption meets the deviation standards. The statute states that a deviation can only be granted if the court determines that the line 24 obligation is unjust or inappropriate and is not in the best interest of the child. If the deviation standards are met, the presumption is rebutted, and the court can view the facts of the case to determine what child support should be ordered. However, if the deviation standard is not met, the presumption is not rebutted, and the court must conclude that the obligations stated on line 24 are the proper amounts due from each parent.
If you take 3113.215C, right, from the Pauley case, what does this sentence mean? If the parents have split parental rights and responsibilities, that's what we have in this case, isn't it?
No, that is not what we have in this case.
Then how does it differ from that? Because that would be the answer to your question to Justice Sweeney, or I think what he was trying to get to.
Then I apologize if I didn't understand your question. Justice Douglas, regarding your question, this is not a split custody case. This is a shared parenting case. With split custody, you have more than one child, and one parent is designated as the residential parent of one child, and another parent is designated as the residential parent of the second child.
So 215C, that sentence has no application in this case.
That is correct, Your Honor. In Pauley, what this court said was C does not apply to shared parenting. This court stated that expressly. Rather, what we said in Pauley was that subpoint B6A applies in shared parenting cases. Indeed, it must. It expressly addresses shared parenting cases.
But shared parenting could be, you see them 2 days a week, 1 day a week, 1 hour a week, and yet you would have us set up a formula that absolutely sets off those financial obligations no matter how often. I mean, in the split arrangement, you can understand one child with one child with the other. There's a certainty there. But here, you have a whole range of visitation, but you want a fixed financial formula that will deal with it whether the father or the mother sees the kid 20 hours a week or sees the kid 2 hours a week.
I don't think that's a proper characterization of what we think the statute says, Your Honor. What we're saying is that when the court gets down to line 24, it must presume that those are the proper amounts. After that initial presumption, either side has the opportunity to rebut the presumption and to say the father's amount is too high or too low, or the mother's amount is too high or too low. It's a starting point. The court still retains discretion to look at the time split, as you point out.
But doesn't the court, if you do it the way that the 10th District does it, doesn't the court still retain that discretion to say, well, we're going to change this a little bit because of circumstances? Even under the 10th District holding, they still have that discretion, don't they? So they can still get to where you want.
Your Honor, with the 10th District, yes, I suppose they retain the power to grant a deviation, but that's not the problem. The problem is the 10th District says without using the deviation standards contained in the statute, we can simply eliminate an obligation. We can treat every shared parenting case as if it was sole custody. And that's where the problem comes. As you point out, we could have a case that is labeled shared parenting, but one parent may only spend 20% of the time with the child. In that case, the starting point that we're recognizing would not be appropriate. That's where the court would use its discretion. But that discretion should not be unbridled. A court should not be allowed to say, for whatever reason, we're just going to eliminate one obligation. the discretion should be exercised judiciously in accordance with established rules. And the only rules in the statute are the deviation standards. They're very specific. What the 10th District did here is they gave a court carte blanche to simply eliminate an obligation without stating determinations, without stating findings, and without putting anything in writing.
That's what they did, but isn't your side the opposite side, which is automatic credit?
No, Your Honor. We are not arguing automatic credit. We are arguing that you must recognize both parents' line 24 obligation, and then each parent can argue for a deviation if they think it is appropriate. What this case is about is what is the appropriate starting point for the exercise of the court's discretion, and what are the rules that should guide that discretion.
Well, Pauly even permits the deviation.
Absolutely. The question is starting point, Justice Douglas.
Okay, but whenever you do the starting point, don't you, to get to your starting point, ask for a credit?
You ask for a deviation from line 24.
That's after you get to the starting point. The deviation comes after the starting point.
Okay.
I'm troubled by the sentence, appellant seeks an automatic credit for the time he has cared for his children. Isn't that what you're looking for?
No, absolutely not. We're seeking to recognize that what the legislature has said is, we're giving you a formula. Courts, we want you to use this formula. That formula tells you what the two numbers should be on line 24. If you want to order something other than what that formula says to order, then you must meet the deviation standards.
Let's be very specific. Isn't your argument that $7,000 should have been entered on the column for wife and it was not? Is that, am I mistaken?
Justice Moyer, our position is that...
That's the beginning point.
Yes, that the mother's line 24 obligation was $7,000, and the court just said, gone.
We're not putting that. We're not putting it on there. We're not including it. It doesn't have to be on the line, I guess, or it doesn't have to be considered, right? Is that?
We think that the $7,000 should have presumptively been the amount that was due from the mother to the father, right. But the mother should have been given the opportunity to say this amount would be inappropriate for the following reasons. And if the court found her arguments to be persuasive, the court could find that it would be appropriate to give her a deviation, maybe
court,
a little, maybe a lot.
The court said we do not need to consider the $7,000, just eliminated that from consideration. That's your argument, is it not? So,
yes, Your Honor.
So the beginning point then is different than what it should have been.
Absolutely.
Because the $7,000, you're arguing the $7,000 should have been included. Court said it doesn't have to be included, and you say that's wrong, because that then changes the point from which a deviation can be sought.
That's exactly right. We say that if you want a deviation, you must meet the deviation standard. The judge can't arbitrarily just make your obligation disappear.
I'm sorry that your light's on. But in Pauly, though we spoke about going through line 24, in Pauly, this court never found that both parties were ordered. It doesn't appear that we actually followed what you hope in terms of saying we get to line 24 and that's, you'd like to call it a presumption. You know, in Pauly it was called automatic. Maybe that's not a big difference, but we didn't allocate the mother's side of that.
Correct. In Pauly, the procedural status of the case when it came to this court was that the lower court had already ignored one parent's obligation. I think that was incorrect, but that issue was simply not before this court. Thus, you didn't have the opportunity to consider it. Thus, I'm here. Anything else?
Thank you, Ms. Jordy.
Thank you.
Mr. Collins.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, at this time I'd like to recognize a few people at council table. My name is Mark Collins, and I work for the law firm of Kloppert, Portman, Sadler, Tannick, and Foley. Seated at council table is an associate, Rory Callahan, as well as Mr. Michael Smaltz, who filed the amicus brief on behalf of five groups, amongst them the group ACES. We ask you to reject appellant's argument in this case and to affirm the Franklin County Court of Appeals decision for three basic reasons. First, the offset that appellant seeks is not contained in the statute. Second, the legislature never intended there to be an offset and specifically excluded it from the last version of Senate Bill 180.
Tell me why the form, I really don't understand this, so tell me what's wrong with, I'm looking at the form under 21.5, it's attached to one of the briefs, and there's a column one for father, column two for mother, and under at line 24, there's an amount for a dollar amount blank for each one. The effect of what the appellant is arguing, it seems to me to be that in column two for the mother, there should have been an amount there, but there is not, or was not. Is that too simplified?
No, Your Honor, I believe, Mr. Chief Justice, that is what they're trying to argue. However, it's incorrect. The statute for shared parenting is the same worksheet that's used for shared parenting and sole custody cases. It lists both parties' obligation. That's the presumed amount. Then there can only be one obligor and one obligee. In the shared parenting case, they list one obligor on the worksheet. The legislature specifically put only one slot for the obligor. So what appellant argues, however, is actually an offset. They're asking for an offset as a starting point. Third, shared parenting does not mean equal parenting.
Counsel, your opponent is advanced might seem equitable in the abstract, might even be fair in the abstract if the next step followed, and that is that the judges felt free and magistrates or whoever is making these initial determinations to then balance it up and weigh. Is this an example of shared parenting, as Justice Stratton pointed out, where it's shared parenting mostly for the benefit of the cocktail hour, where you can go say, we have shared parenting, and in reality, mom's taking care of the kids, and father, if he doesn't have a golf game, shows up
That's exactly our point, Your Honor.
Spend some time with the kids, because that is, there are those kinds of shared parenting as well.
As Judge McGee Brown noted in her brief, Your Honor.
My question is, shared parenting is an option. And could you give us, can you take off your advocate hat for a moment and give us your take on what it would mean to the shared parenting option in terms of lawyers counseling women?
Yes,
if the result that they seek obtains, will they just say, it's off? Will the lawyers say to women, you really shouldn't consider this because it runs the risk of a financial downside that you wouldn't otherwise have to face?
Yes, Your Honor, the dynamics are twofold. First, lawyers will advise clients, whether male or female, to say, you must litigate just to get the term shared parenting. Because under appellant's theory, if you get the term shared parenting, you immediately get a natural offset at credit because you start at a lower point. In this specific case, the magistrate was able to analyze it on the unique facts of this case. The magistrate determined at the trial level that the shared parenting plan that was occurring here, the parenting time, was a 60% for mother, 40% for father. Mother still has 50% more of the time. The magistrate, on a case-by-case basis, was allowed to analyze it and say, we believe a deviation is appropriate. To go back to Justin Stratton's question, if you take an example of two shared parenting plans, Family A and Family B, both get shared parenting orders, as you indicated. All four parties make the identical amount of income. However, Family A has a true 50-50 sharing of time. Family B, mother has 75%, father has 25%. Under appellant's version or mechanism of an offset, the parties would start at a much lower rate. That would fundamentally undermine the adequacy of the child support payments that an individual is to receive. In this particular case, the presumed amount where the court started at was $8,696 as for the obligation for appellant. The deviation granted based on the facts germane to this case was a 40% deviation, an amount down to $4,986. Under appellant's version, when you work the math, the initial starting point, which he made in his argument, would then be $1,696 that appellant's initial obligation would start from. So no two shared parenting plans are alike, no two are similar, and that's what Judge McGee Brown noted in her trial brief. You cannot make a fundamentally rule or mechanism that is the beginning point.
So, that means that it doesn't, the realities of this practice and this the issues that come before these courts do not support a presumption.
That's correct.
And that's, we really need, I mean, that your learned opponent sees it that way, that it would be sound fair to have a presumption. You suggest a presumption isn't workable.
It's not workable because it turns the system on its head. It starts at the end rather than at the beginning. And it takes away the discretion of the trial court to adjudicate the facts of each case on a case-by-case basis because you're starting at a point much lower.
Although case-by-case is, you know, really guidelines are in an effort to standardize somewhat. So, you have to be fair, you have to acknowledge that the statutory scheme seeks to avoid everything being case by case.
I agree, Your Honor. However, the statutory scheme here, we believe, is quite clear. Under Marker v. Grimm, this court determined that all terms of 3113.215 were to be taken mandatory and followed literally and technically in all material respects. Appellant asks you to create a new computation after line 24, which would result in an offset. This new computation clearly flies in the face of Marker v. Grimm. Now, in Pauley, in a unanimous decision by this court basically said subsection C does not apply in shared parenting cases for child support orders. However, subsection B6A should apply. Perversely, the 1st and 11th District Courts misapplied the Pauley ruling. Appellant stands before you today making the same argument that was made in Pauley. They're simply window dressing it. The misapplication by the 1st and the 11th districts was due to the fact that the appellant in Pauley said, hey, I'm a residential parent. Subsection C says a residential parent's obligation should be spent on the time that I spend with my child. Therefore, I'm allowed an automatic credit. This court rejected that argument. It should reject it then. It should reject it now. The misapplication by the two other courts of appeals occurred because they got hung up on the term residential parent. That's what appellant hangs their hat on, the term residential parent. It was created in child custody legislation, not child support legislation.
Would you go back and give me the legislative history? Because my understanding is that this was considered, the offset was considered and was specifically rejected in legislative history. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Your Honor, and I refer you to the amici curiae brief filed by Mr. Smalls. Since 1990, the legislature has grappled with the issue of an automatic offset in shared parenting cases. Most recently, as Senate Bill 180, an automatic offset with a time formula was inserted into the original version of the bill. It was specifically excluded. That speaks volumes. The fact that we know the legislature knows how to use the mechanism because it does so in split custody cases. Subsection C in split custody cases says when one parent has one child and the other child, you qualify under subsection C, therefore you get the automatic offset. They specifically included it in subsection C, they specifically excluded it in subsection D6A and did not put it in the worksheet.
Earlier you said there should not be any presumption. Whenever you have a case of one parent having the residential parent having custody for a longer or possession longer than 50% of the time, in your example 75 and 25, doesn't that immediately raise a presumption on that side? It's a presumption against any set-off.
The presumption actually starts, Your Honor, at the initial point of the presumed guideline or guideline child support. Then, if a court deems it appropriate and a party meets the factors laid out under B6A and B3A with regards to deviations, they're then allowed to get a deviation. Sometimes it can be a downward deviation. Other times it may be an upward deviation. But that should be left specifically to the trial court in order to determine that deviation.
I thought I understood this matter when I wrote the Marker case. As I recall, I wrote the Marker case, didn't I? Yeah. And I thought we said that you have to compute, just as the Chief Justice pointed out, all the way down, and there's a line for each side. There's nothing on the mother's side here.
In the shared parenting worksheet, which is the same as the sole custody worksheet, the lines go down all the way till each person's presumed child support amount. However, the legislature then in the worksheet simply said there will be one obligor and one obligee. One person receives the check. They simply left it as one person to receive it, one person to pay.
So based on the figures, after you compute them all the way down, I thought we said in Marker.
That's correct, Your Honor. And a basic fundamental...
That computation didn't take place, did it?
It did take place in this action. The magistrate at the trial court level came down to line 24, took both of theirs, then determined that on the basis of the 60-40 split parenting time that father was the obligor, mother was the obligee, and therefore only one line is in terms of a support obligation.
Was there an entry for the wife's obligation?
Up on line 24, not below that.
Okay. Does Marker require it to go be carried beyond line 24?
No, Your Honor.
If we took the other side's interpretation, you would start with, in this case, you would have started with the obligation only being 1,500 sums. Then if you ask for deviation, you're fighting to get more money rather than a reduction. You're saying, okay, that's not enough, he does it because he only has the kids. You have to fight to get more money, whereas the deviation with the other version is reducing the obligation. It seems to me that that is a lot easier point from which to deal to reduce one side's obligation than to try to argue that they ought to pay more despite the final figure on the chart.
It makes much more sense, Your Honor. And the additional reason it does is because not only will you have people litigating just the issue of shared parenting, but then whoever, if the automatic credit is granted, as appellant seeks, the person who is getting the short end of the stick, so to speak, will then have to try to petition for an upward deviation, which goes contrary to the underlying themes and purposes behind the child support guideline statutes. A fundamental tool that's used in interpreting this statute is the principle that if there's an exception carved out for a statute, all other exceptions are precluded. Under B6A, in shared parenting cases for child support, the exception is the deviation factor. Therefore, all other exceptions are precluded. The same situation is in effect for subsection C. You start with the presumed amount. The exception is if you have split custody, you then get the offset. Therefore, all other exceptions are precluded. Unless or until the legislature decides to revise the child support statutes, Ohio courts should apply B6A in shared parenting cases and follow the deviation factors and not grant an automatic offset. Appellant stands before you today asking you to create law, not construe or interpret it. When appellant indicates that they don't want an offset, that's inconsistent with their brief and inconsistent with the case law that they rely on from Luke versus Luke and Weinberger versus Weinberger. Each of those courts misapplied Pauley. Not only once, one court actually misapplied it, Pauley came back, they then wanted to get the same result that they did the first time, so they misapplied it a second time. We believe that since the statute doesn't speak to it, the legislature did not intend for the statute to contain it, most recently as Senate Bill 180 this past year, and the fact that shared parenting does not mean equal parenting, and to apply an automatic offset, which appellant is actually seeking here, would lead to arbitrary and inconsistent child support orders that go against the purpose and nature of the child support statutes.
At the bottom line, what would be the syllabus that you would like to see us write in this case?
I would be most happy with just the Pauley decision, Your Honor, and basically saying that this is the same issue that we addressed in Pauley, that they're playing semantics with the terms and the misapplications of Pauley. But basically, there should be no offset of credit until the legislature deems it appropriate, and they've grappled with it for the past 12 years. This court should interpret the statute literally and technically, and should follow Pauley in this case.
Quickly carry me through the math and an example.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
$10,000. Just quickly carry me through the math so I understand.
In this specific,
You've got. Let's assume that you have a $10,000 support obligation total. That's what it's going to take to support the child or children. And the lines show $6,000 for the husband, $4,000 for the mother. Then, if you wipe out the $4,000 and just give the percentage of the $6,000, would the child support obligation total be more than the $10,000?
No, not at all. It would be drastically less, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may I go into an explanation to answer his question? Thank you. It would be less because when you're indicating that it would be wiped out, meaning that the $4,000 goes away,
uh-huh.
and that net appellant or father would only have to pay $2,000, the starting point then becomes, under appellant's theory, the $2,000 amount.
Wiped away means they don't consider it at all. You're taking it as his position is a discount.
That's correct.
Four from the six is two. But I'm saying that they don't consider the four at all.
They do, Your Honor.
What I thought happened here.
Right. They don't, Your Honor.
Okay. So he then pays $6,000.
That's his presumed guideline amount. He has the ability then to petition to lower it if he meets certain factors.
Okay, the court doesn't grant that. So he's got, what does he pay? 60% of the $6,000 or all $6,000?
He pays all $6,000.
Right. Okay. So he pays $6,000.
Yes.
And her $4,000. That was wiped out, not considered, equals the $10,000, which is the amount, so it comes out the same.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Mr. Doherty, use your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Under my example, with your argument, the total obligation of support, not the total obligation, the total revenue that comes in is less than $10,000.
As I understood your example, you said the father presumptively pays $6,000 and the mother presumptively pays $4,000.
That's what we end up with on line 24.
Okay.
Four and six.
Right.
So we're going to ignore the four. He pays six.
That's not my policy.
He pays six.
Mm-hmm.
She has the four she's paying because she has the children. It comes out $10,000. Now, you want a deduction from the $6,000.
I don't know. That would depend on the facts of the case, Your Honor.
Well, that's what we have here, I think.
Well, what we're saying is that we don't write with a clean slate. We have the statute that says the amounts on line 24 must be presumed, and there's only one exception to that, subdivision C, which addresses sole custody. It says in a sole custody case where only one parent has been designated as the residential parent, it's okay to ignore that parent's obligation.
Now, wait a minute. Just stick with the example. You got the $6,000. You don't want to pay the total $6,000. You want some credit against that. I'm looking for the right word. You don't like set off. You don't like ignoring. How about some credit? You want some credit against that. You don't want your client to pay the full $6,000.
If I was representing the father in that case, if the facts justified a deviation, I would argue that the court should grant a deviation and his obligation should be less than six. If I was representing the mother and I thought that $4,000 was too much for her, I would argue that she should receive a deviation. The court would then grant a deviation for one or for both. The court would then come up with a final number for the father,
which is going to be less than what the child support obligation chart shows. That's the problem I struggled with in Marker. That's why when you get to that point, if you reduce the $6,000, let's say for deviation, if you want to use that,
okay.
$4,000, then you got $4,000 from him, $4,000 from her, that's $8,000, and the standard says it's got to be $10,000.
Justice Douglas, the thing you forget is the following. People support their children not just by paying child support to an ex-spouse. They support their children every day when the children live in their house.
No, I don't get that. I had four. And I can tell you that I understand that, but we're dealing with a schedule.
Yes, sir.
The $4,000 is not actually wiped out. It's presumed that she's going to contribute that because she has the kids the majority of the time. That's the presumption that the legislature has made.
I respectfully disagree. That is not what the statute says, Your Honor.
Didn't they specifically take out that section that lets you do the formula that you want? They took it out in the last version.
We're dealing with the version that was in effect.
Is the attorney correct that in the original, one of the original versions, they had a formula like you want and they took it out? Is that legislative history correct?
That is absolutely incorrect. What he's talking about is at different times in the past, the legislature has considered what they call a time-based adjustment. The legislature has decided not to include a time-based adjustment in the statute because it's too simplistic. They've said, well, maybe one parent would have the child for a greater period of time, but maybe the other parent is paying for private school, maybe there's special needs involved. There's a whole plethora of other factors that may come into play. So the legislature said, we will not be shackled by time alone. We want to give the courts the discretion to deviate from the two line 24 numbers based on the totality of the circumstances. The legislature...
Isn't your response, just to make sure I understand this, the deviation aspect, isn't your response to Justice Douglas's point about the $6,000 to $4,000 that the statute does give the trial court the opportunity to take into account the fact that the father in this case could be the mother. Mother may be the high earner, but in this case the father, that the father may be making a substantial contribution in some other way, private school, for instance, or maybe extraordinary medical expenses, and so that $6,000 can be reduced to reflect the fact that the father, the obligor, is paying some extraordinary amount of support that doesn't show up in the formula. Is that correct?
That's correct, but it goes beyond that. It also reflects the fact that if a child is living with, let's again say the father, 40 or 50% of the time, the father is paying for non-extraordinary things, food, clothing, shelter, utilities. All of those come into play.
But isn't that part of the formula in the shared parenting?
Yes, it is, and that's why...
That's taken into account the normal things that one does for a child if they're living with a parent. That's taken into account. Is it in the formula or is it not?
It's taken into account in that when you look at the schedule, it says for two parents whose income is approximately this amount and who have this number of children, the approximate total amount of support that should be paid is a certain number. The formula then divides that number between the parents proportionately based on their income. So what we're saying is that is the logical starting point. It is presumed that Papa should pay his line 24 amount and that Mama should pay her line 24 amount, but the court retains absolute discretion to deviate from either of those numbers if the deviation standards are met. If the deviation standards are not met, they should stick with the line 24 numbers, offset them so there's not duplicity in terms of the order, and issue one net order. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your client got a 40% deviation from this formula, correct?
Yes, he did.
Now, if we had accepted your version of the formula, he would owe roughly $1,500. Would he have still gone for another 40% deviation, so he only had to pay $800 a year?
He would not have owed $1,500. That would have been the presumptive amount. And if the mother thought that was too low,
she could argue for more.
That's
a theoretical presumption. If you went by the formula, he would owe $1,500, roughly $1,500, correct?
I believe that's the right number.
And then you would still have the right to go and ask for a 40% reduction because you have the kids 40% of the time.
No, that is incorrect.
Why not?
Because what we're arguing is once you get the two line 24 numbers, at that point in time, you argue for a deviation. In fact, if you look at the worksheet,
Your
Honor...
But why wouldn't you argue for a deviation? You say you should offset the two. You know, it's equal incomes or relatively equal incomes. We should offset the two. I owe $1,500, but, you know, I have the kids 40% of the time.
So I get a 40% reduction, I only owe them $800. That's the deviation that you would want to seek, because you have the kids 40% of the time. Why wouldn't you, as a good lawyer, argue that?
Well, I'm not saying that I wouldn't, but I'm saying the statute is more complicated than that. The statute says that the court retains its discretion to order a deviation up or down for either parent, and then after the court has determined if there will be a deviation for either parent, there is a final number. And once the final numbers are determined, it is those numbers that must be netted. Indeed, line 26 specifically directs a court to determine not only what deviation, if any, should be granted, but it indicates that the court must indicate numerically a specific amount of the deviation. And then line 27 is the line on which we go from two obligations to one child support order. Our system merely recognizes the statutory presumption. It recognizes that a deviation cannot be granted unless the standards in the statute are met, and it preserves the court's discretion to do whatever is appropriate and to issue whatever order is appropriate given the facts and circumstances of the individual case.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.